Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. I'll tell you what I want to say to you today. I want to tell you why I am not a conservative. Now, I realize that sounds like it's a shocker since I've been typecast as this and as that for 15 years, but I am not a conservative. I realized today that by declaring myself anything, I immediately turn off 50% of the potential listeners. Now, I declared myself an independent when I began because I was never a registered Republican in my adult life, so far as I can recall. But today, everyone's an independent. Nobody wants to be labeled a Republican, certainly, or a Democrat. I don't believe that that's a proper label for me. I don't believe being an independent is sufficient today. I would call myself either a realist or a pragmatist, and that's going to be my new designation to you. And I'll tell you why. I'm usually 100% right about everything. I'm rarely wrong. It's a product of a great mind, a great education, and a very curious mind and a long life. That's number three. Three things that you cannot match and you can't create overnight. Just as fine wine takes time to make, let me tell you something about it. Fine talk shows take a long time to make as well. Let me give you an example. I'm going to start with a rather obscure, unimportant story in some ways, but it goes to the bigger problems that we are having with the charlatan, giggles the president. There was a report the other day about an ABC News reporter who was found stabbed in his apartment. I read the story. I saw Brooklyn stabbings. I said to my producer, it was Saturday or Sunday, I said it was a gay sex murder. They said, oh, come on, it has nothing to do with gay. I mean, we've known the guy. He worked in the Bay Area. No one ever knew he was gay. The New York Police Department, to their credit, cracked the case within less than a week. And they found a so-called troubled teenager who is now accused of stabbing WABC newsman George Weber. Now, why he's a troubled teenager, I don't know. All teenagers are troubled. But it turns out the WABC newsman, God rest his soul, George Weber, looked for rough sex on the internet. He found a 16-year-old Satan-loving sadomasochist with a knife fetish, and he wound up bound at the ankles in duct tape, naked from the waist down, and stabbed to death. How is it that the New York Police Department can crack this case within a couple of days? How is it that the New York Police Department was able to solve this murder while police in San Francisco are unable to solve almost any murder? What is it about the fact that the New York Police Department, which now solves only about half of the murders in the city, by the way, a few years ago it was 80%, it's now down to 50%, but that's still twice as many as either San Francisco or Oakland, California. Who is to blame for the fact that the San Francisco Police Department cannot solve murders? Why can't they solve murders? I'd like your calls on this. But let's go back to the main point. It's a sad story. The guy had a weakness. He had a weakness. He had a perversion. He indulged in his weakness. He indulged in his perversion, and he got stabbed to death. That's a very sad story. But I saw from the minute I read the story, I said it has all the earmarks of a rough trade murder. And I knew it, and I was right. I'm usually right about everything. That's why I'm in radio, and that's why I've been successful in radio. Let me tell you something. If I was more wrong than I am right about things, I wouldn't have lasted the 15 years I've lasted. So whether you like my politics or not doesn't matter. I'm usually right about everything. And I'm telling you right now that Obama is an imposter. Obama is over his head. It's not that he's too black, he's too green. I said that when he was running. The guy does not know what he's doing, and he's faking it. And we all know he got away with it because of his friends in the media who are still covering for him. He's bankrupting America to an extent that we'll never recover from. Sure, George Bush was no bargain, but don't blame Bush on me. There was no harsher critic of Bush, and in a friendly way, than me. And I mean in a friendly way. There is friendly criticism, and then there's malicious criticism. I was a friendly critic of George Bush. It had no effect on him whatsoever. He continued to do what he was going to do anyway. But right now we're stuck with this imposter, Giggles the president. And you say, well, what does that have to do with ABC Newsman killed during homosexual rough sex tryst? Because I called that one the minute I read the story and saw the picture. And I'm seeing the picture of Obama. And I'm telling you the man is an imposter. So having said that, now let's move on. Let's move on to take some calls on these and other topics here on the Savage Nation. There are other topics. For example, here's the headline on my top left story on michaelsavage.com. Gays again see virulent TB strain emerging. Now, I had a struggle to write that headline because if you read the article, they hide the fact that it's emerging amongst gays again. That's what you would expect from a failing newspaper, wouldn't you? And it says, here's the headline from the local paper, which is going out of business. Study finds a different type of TB patient. The rate of TB in San Francisco has been dropping over the last decade, but health officials say they're seeing a new type of TB patient, someone who isn't poor or homeless or a newly arrived immigrant. Now, of course, they don't add the sentence. They say it's mainly amongst gay white males, but they didn't add that. Now they can't even put that in the article. Rather, the disease is now being found in low-risk settings that don't usually harbor TB. At an affluent high school, a law office, bars, even at a venture capital firm. So you have to read the whole article and get to the bottom of it to find out what's going on is what went on already. Public health workers launched an aggressive screening campaign among a dozen bars in the Castro and South of Market neighborhoods. Now, if you're outside of the Bay Area, you don't know that that's a gay neighborhood. It turns out 4% of bar employees were positive for tuberculosis. Now, the question is, why am I talking about it? Because tuberculosis is an opportunistic infection. It was one of the first infections that appeared when HIV first made its major appearance on the world stage here in America in the early 1980s. It was tuberculosis that first had a resurgence amongst mainly white homosexual males. And the reason I know a lot about this is because I'm a trained epidemiologist with a degree in the field, number one. And I also know there's a precursor to the reason that it invaded the gay community. HIV is a disease that weakens the immune system. I'm speaking in generalities now. And that is why opportunistic infections appear in an individual with weakened immune systems. One of the first diseases to have appeared in the gay community in the early 80s was tuberculosis, because the immune systems were down. And you have to ask yourself, well, why did TB appear in the gay community? Why TB? The answer has to be looked, you have to look back 10 years before the 1980s to get that answer. And that was because of the large influx of Indo-Chinese refugees. Remember the boat people from Vietnam? They called them Indo-Chinese refugees. The large influx of refugees from Vietnam brought with that influx a tremendous incidence of tuberculosis, because you still don't want to accept the fact that TB is rampant in Asia, as is hepatitis. I know you have mythology about Asia and Asian health, but you don't understand that the health in Asia is terrible, just horrendous. You don't understand that a liver disease, hepatitis, is rampant in China in particular, and so is tuberculosis, as it is in Mexico. So in the 70s, you have an influx of Indochinese refugees, many of them carrying tuberculosis, some passive, some active. You then have a gay community that in which the HIV virus proliferates. The immune system in the gay community is knocked down. Infections take place. The number one infection at the time was tuberculosis. Then others, of course, appeared as well. So you have to ask yourself, why is tuberculosis now all of a sudden resurging in the gay community in San Francisco? Well, almost for the same exact reasons it did so 25 or 30 years ago, because of the large influx of immigrants with tuberculosis in San Francisco. As a matter of fact, there are regions of the Mission District in San Francisco that have a higher incidence of tuberculosis than do areas of West Africa. In fact, there are areas in San Francisco with an incidence of tuberculosis higher than most places in the third world, again covered up by the local failed newspaper, the same failed newspaper that covers up murders, the same failed newspaper that covers up commonsensical stories. And so we go back again to ABC News reporter killed in rough trade gay sex murder. We go back to the TV story, and you see a cover-up wherever you turn. Now, if you can see a cover-up in murders, and if you see a cover-up by the newspapers with regard to diseases, why should you assume you're not seeing a cover-up by these psychopaths in the news business when it comes to Giggles, the president? Huh? I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. So now the latest on the killing of the ABC newsman is that the teen was found wearing the murdered newsman's clothing. Ooh. He stabbed the newsman 50 times, say the cops. Of course, the newspapers are spinning it that you should have sympathy for the murderer, that he's a troubled teen. Troubled. All right, he's troubled teen. He's a psychopath. What do you mean troubled? What do you mean troubled? What are you implying, that if Obama's stimulus plan had passed, there would have been knife training and he wouldn't have done this? Or maybe you can blame it upon slavery or something. That if only he had been raised in another environment and had proper mentoring, he'd be slicing locks instead of newsmen. He'd be working in a kosher deli in the Bronx instead of stabbing people to death. That's what I'll hear next, that he needed proper training. That the stimulus plan would have saved him with knife training for the young teen who had. Violent sex ad led to murder of WABC newsman George Weber, confesses teen cops. So they broke the case in a few days. Obviously, there are homicide detectives in New York, still worth the name homicide detectives. And they went on to the victim's website. They found the guy who he had met online last week and had arranged to meet, said Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly. There was going to be an exchange of money. So they broke the case within a few days. That's not going to bring the victim back to life. But here in San Francisco, murders go unsolved. And that there's a multitude of reasons for this. In New York City, in the NYPD, you still have homicide detectives. In the SFPD, we have homicide detectives, micromanaged from the top down by the woman with the big hat. The woman with the big hat decides which murders get solved and which murders don't get solved. And the people are such schmucks in San Francisco that all they care about is who has the best latte. Who has the best latte? Where's the best place for a bike ride? Ooh, let's go out at night on Friday and tie up the traffic. Former teen charge, troubled teen. Blah, blah, blah. How come they can't solve murders in San Francisco? And by the way, the homicide resolution rate, whatever they call it, is about 50% in New York, which is way down from what it was a few years ago. It was like 80%, 85. San Francisco's always been in the toilet in the last 10, 15 years. It's not just this administration under any Tewsome Newsome, believe me. After the murder Friday, Cathesis shed his bloody clothes and fled Weber's pad in some of the victim's clothes, only to land in cop custody after a G-Train conductor reported a passenger bleeding profusely from his left hand. Catethis, whatever, was taken, blah, blah, blah. Hoping to hide at a friend's house, cops nabbed him there, still dressed in Weber's clothes at a bus depot, blah, blah, blah. Catethis admitted stabbing Weber, the newsman, after an ad the newsman placed on the internet looking for rough sex, but claimed self-defense. Oh, it's already self-defense. He got already a shyster lawyer. I get it. Uh-huh. Oh, I see. He was a victim. The guy who stabbed the newsman was a victim. Catethis, who lives with a separate appearance in East Elmhurst, Queens, posted pictures of himself with various blades, including one he held against his neck. He also issued a chilling warning. If you disrespect me, then I will blank break your neck, he wrote. Called himself on his own website extremist, anarchist, sadomasochist, and he enjoys long conversations, drinking, bike riding, and hanging out. He sounds like he's perfect to work for San Francisco. Perfect for Mayor Newsom at $100,000 a year. I mean, anyone who can have long conversations and likes drinking, bike riding, and hanging out is a perfect, actually he's perfect to run the Acorn division of the Obama administration. The teen also listed more reckless hobbies like, quote, roof hopping, I never heard of that, hanging off trains, and violent video games. That's great. So here's a newsman who's sick in the head. He's dead, God rest his soul, who who looks for wild sex, finds it, and gets stabbed to death. That's all. Now you know who writes the news. Now you can't generalize. But I'm going to make another general point anyway, even though I'm not supposed to, I will. You ask yourself why the journalist profession has so degenerated to the point that it's not taken seriously by virtually anyone anymore. Why is it that the newspapers are going out of business? Why is it that the newspapers are no longer seen as credible by the readership that is still out there, clamoring for some some semblance of the truth? I will tell you why, and that is because a goodly percentage of those in the media, shall I say, are ambiguous sexually. Let's put it to you that way. They have sexual problems. They were never smart enough to become doctors or dentists or lawyers. Usually they were C students and they went into journalism. I'm telling you like I see it. Make believe I'm your uncle who was sitting over dinner and you don't like what you're hearing. I'm telling you the way I see it. Most of the people who go into this business were C students at best. They couldn't do anything else. They weren't stupid exactly. Now you add to that mix a certain sexual ambiguity, and they distrust authority to begin with, and they don't want any concept of rules, any concept of rules. They don't like church. They don't like synagogue. They don't like the authority figures. They want to become the authority figure. So that's all I'm going to say on this issue right now, but I want to go back to my main point. I read this story. The day I read it, I said to my producer, you can ask him, Beowulf, come on the air right now. Are you there? Hit a button.
Right here, sir.
All right, Beowulf is my producer, Beowulf Rockland. When did I pick up on this story? Was it over the weekend? When did it first appear?
You told me about it on Monday, and that's when you
Right, and didn't I? What did I say to you right off the bat? I said, I'll bet you that this was what?
You said that this was probably a gay sex crime of some sort.
Okay, and I said rough trade sex.
That's
and you
right.
said and you said I don't think that's possible.
I was
because,
wrong, you were right.
Well, it's not that you were wrong and I was right. This newsman, God rest his soul, had worked out here, and there was no implication of any kind of anomaly in that regard, right?
Absolutely not. No, I remember hearing him back in the 90s.
No. I mean, he worked at a local station. Everyone had good things to say about him. He was a nice guy. But when I saw stabbing in his Borum Hill apartment, I said, it has all the earmarks of a rough trade sex act gone wild, gone wrong. Now, it's the same thing with almost everything else. I can figure things out pretty much as they are. I don't need anyone to tell me what I should think. I certainly don't need Obama the Magnificent, who I affectionately call Giggles the President, to tell me what reality is. I'm the realist,
Savage.
Not him.
Of course, there are difficult problems that we both face. We're going to try to be helpful in, you know, stopping the flow of guns and trying to reduce the demand for the flow of drugs. We recognize that we have a responsibility.
Here's Hillary Clinton stabbing America in the back. She goes to Mexico as Secretary of State. Instead of saying, we're going to put the military on the border to stop the drug violence from spilling over into our country, she says we have responsibility for the violence spilling over into our country. Now, you understand that Obama and his minions are basically, how shall I put it in a delicate manner? They're blame America first people. Let's put it to you that way. Here's this cretin, Geithner, who works for him, this moron, who today says he's open to the proposal by China to drop the U.S. dollar and come up with a new world currency. The dollar drops on this moron's comment. Foreign exchange markets are roiled. This guy is a psychopath that needs to be thrown out immediately. We got Giggles the Clown running America. We got one inexperienced lunatic after another stabbing us in the back, and the country is going down the drain. People are catching on, but I don't know if they're going to catch on fast enough. Again, am I right or wrong? I'm right. I can read the tea leaves. This psycho, Geithner, who is also as corrupt as they come, don't think he's such a Boy Scout. He may look like a Cub Scout, but he's a corrupt, in my opinion, a corrupt, fettered individual. This bum was at the Federal Reserve Bank while the bonuses were given out to the AIG people. This bum was at the Federal Reserve while the country melted down under George Bush, and now he's acting like he doesn't know what happened. Now, this same cretin Geithner at the Council on Foreign Relations, an un-American, anti-American group, says the U.S. is open to a headline-grabbing proposal by the governor of the China Central Bank to replace the dollar with a new global currency. Can you believe this? He says we're actually quite open to that suggestion. You should see it as rather evolutionary, rather building on the current architecture, rather than moving us to global monetary union. This is Geithner, our Treasury Secretary, saying the dollar should be dropped for some concept of a new world currency created by our dear friends, the kidney eaters of China. This guy is insane. He's trying to destroy the U.S. dollar. This is the new world order that I've been talking about for years. Here is China calling the shots for a new one global currency. I guess they'll call it the Worldo. He is not a distinguished central banker. This guy is a communist. Obama is a communist. Geithner is a communist. They are the Manchurian candidates you have feared all your life. New global currency? New global currency? Are these people totally crazy? What is it going to take for the average American to awaken to the fact that we are living with an anti-American administration running the show? Well, I'll take your calls, 1-800-449-8255. New York City, WOR. Frankie, go ahead, please.
Good evening. I just wanted to say that if a 50-year-old man was seeking to have sexual relations with a 15- or 16-year-old girl, he would be accused of rape and roundly vilified in the press. Here we have a situation in New York where a 50-year-old man was seeking to have sex with a 15-and-a-half-year-old, just barely 16-year-old boy. Needless to say, the result of this was tragic. However, it should not be overlooked that this 50-year-old man was engaged not only in immoral but criminal behavior. He was attempting and did, in fact, seduce a minor, a 16-year-old boy.
Yeah, let's call it like it is. This newsman for WABC was a pedophile. You want to just open it up to reality? The famous radio personality who they suddenly have sympathy for was a cocaine-using pedophile. He liked rough sex and bondage. He paid underage boys to come to his apartment. He supplied the illegal drugs and vodka. Now, it's sad that he's dead, but the fact of the matter is this guy was a pedophile.
Well, Michael, the result was tragic, but when you engage in criminal behavior, anything can happen, Michael.
Well, the result was tragic, but it was somewhat predictable, wasn't it? When you start looking for crazy people like this to satisfy your deepest insanities, you're liable to wind up hurt.
Well, I think the facts speak for themselves, Michael. The result was tragic.
The guy was a pedophile. The only reason you're not seeing it and the reason they're calling him a newsman is because they're sympathetic to a fellow so-called journalist. You understand that, right? They're looking out for their own. They're covering up for one of their own. That's the whole story in a nutshell. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. All these stories are horrible. Horrible! But they're part and parcel of what's wrong with America, what's wrong with the world, and what's wrong with the country today, what's wrong with the media. This is who's in the media. Not 100%. We had another wonderful radio personality from San Francisco, I believe from the same local station, who's now in a prison in Texas. He also had a proclivity for youngsters. He also had a little proclivity for youngsters, another great liberal. Why is it that the liberals, how shall I reverse it? Why is it that every pedophile who's caught seems to be a radical liberal in the media or an ACLUer? What is the connection? Do you know how many heads of ACLU chapters over the last 5 years were caught by the FBI and are in jail now for pedophilia? Very, very large number. That's why they're in the ACLU, to make sure you can't bust them. They're projecting their own guilt onto the legal scene, and by projecting their guilt, they start to get paranoid about everything on earth. And so that's how the real problems metastasize, because they're only worried about getting caught in what they're doing. That's my opinion. That's what a progressive is, basically, a pervert covering it up with liberal politics. You scratch the surface of a progressive and usually find a pervert, one way or the other. Gary on WOR, welcome to the program.
I just wanted to say to the Godfather, how do you thank someone who has taken you from crayons to cologne? And I'm in my 50s.
Wait, you taken someone from crayons to what?
Cologne. You know, like from that movie, To Sir With Love. You know, how do you thank someone who has...
I thought you said, how do you thank someone who took you from crayons to Corona, the beer?
No, to Cologne. No. I stopped.
So what's your main point today, Gary?
Thanks to the Godfather, I've learned how to, develop an instinct for watching out. I work in public service in mass transit, and you learn in my professional capacity, thanks to the Godfather's warnings and teachings, how to look out for community activists and how they cloak their...
Oh, how they cloak their do-gooderness, really, in their crimes and do-gooderness. You see, the four dead cops in San Francisco are dead for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the man Obama appointed to the White House Council on the Environment, a low-life SOB who spent 10 years harassing the police of Oakland and San Francisco with a group called Cop Watch, intimidating the police into not being able to do their jobs. That's why they're dead. And now he was, of course, appointed by Obama to see if he can do it on a federal scale.
Thank you. And I'll hang up and listen to the rest of you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Last night I was driving home from the radio show, and again, I tune in some shows, I scan, and there's a local show that they call, I won't mention his name, he's known his first name is Queen. Let's put it to you that way, it rhymes with Queen. And Queen was covering, and a caller identified herself as a black lawyer for the city of Oakland a number of years ago. And she was talking about the killing of the four policemen, and she went on and on and on about how blacks are picked on by the police, how they're stopped by the police, how they're harassed by the police, and the Queen didn't interrupt her once. Now, if that woman had tried that with me, I would have just said, look, dear, what are you saying? You're glad the cops are dead? They got what they deserved? Is that your implication? And on and on. Now, that's the difference between a professional like myself and a man who tried the national stage and flopped and was then relegated back to a local yokel talk show. Because you can't get away with that nationally. The people have better ears and there are more of them. And you're not talking to a single audience, you're talking to the nation. And so these four policemen, going back to that horrible story, are dead because of the man that Obama appointed to the White House. This man ran a group called Cop Watch. He ran around with a group of so-called community activists with video cameras harassing the police, the ACLU, the district attorneys like Terrence Hallinan, in my opinion, killed those cops. Every left-wing lawyer in the Bay Area has the blood of these cops on their hands for what they've done to the police over the years. I'm not blind. I know what's going on, and I can see what's going on. As I said to you, I can see between the story. I can read the tea leaves, however you want to put it. I know what's going on. I know why those police are dead, because they hesitated. This never would have happened. Never would have happened if they could have just pulled that piece of garbage out of the car and given him a good shellacking with a nightstick and put him in handcuffs. Then they would be alive. Then they would have had another DNA test, and they would have found the rapist, and they would have found the murderer. But now there are four cops who are dead, and all the liberals are happy. They're thrilled that four cops are dead. They keep score. Every time a cop is killed, they say, good. You don't know any of this, but I know everything. I'm the all-knowing Swami here in the radio business. Florida, Harry, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Dr. Savage, you know that the conduct of Hillary Clinton isn't an exception at all. All these progressives that go to foreign countries and meet with their leaders, without exception, run down the United States. There's John Kerry when he went to Vietnam and to Syria. There's Nancy Pelosi when she went to Syria. And this Hillary with the Palestinians there, with Arafat's wife in New York, gave her a big, fat, juicy kiss. And Mort Zuckerman, that poor deluded fool, said, gee, this isn't the Hillary we know.
No. Well, it is the Hillary we all knew. It is the Hillary we've all known. She's a lifetime Leninist who has recently become very wealthy because of her husband's ability to convert his celebrity into a cash cow. And that's the only good news, is that I hope that the greed will eventually moderate their politics. But for her to go to Mexico when we have a drug war spilling over our borders, and to go over there and say it's our fault because of the use of the cocaine and because we're sending them weapons, is a disaster. It's a disaster. What she should have said to that puppet in Mexico is, we're going to be putting the military on the border. We're moving M1A Abrams tanks onto the border. Thank you very much. We're building concertina wire across the whole border. And anyone who comes across the border will be searched. And if they have illegal drugs, we're going to arrest them. That's what she should have said. I didn't hear any of that, did you? Instead, she apologized.
I agree. I want to run one thing by you here that I think you're alluding to it if you haven't said it outright already. And when that is that Barack Obama, people are mystified when they wonder, why are you doing this when we're in a depression? That's not going to cause any growth, never has. World opinion is against it. And he goes on anyway. He was asked during the campaign, are you going to raise capital gains taxes? And he said, yes. But studies have proven and experience has proven that it doesn't result in more revenue. It results in less. He said, I'm going to do it anyway.
Why do you think I call him Giggles the president? Because Giggles has never run a business. Giggles has never held a job. Giggles has always had it done for him. Giggles was given scholarships. Giggles was given editorships. Giggles was given the presidency. Giggles has never had to meet a payroll. He doesn't understand what it is to build and run a business, Harry.
Exactly. I want to know your opinion whether you think that Barack Obama is deliberately trying to burn down the capitalist house.
No, I don't think so. I think he's an ignorant man who poses as a glib man. Or shall I say a glib man who is quite ignorant of reality. And he thinks just by getting on and shining it on and giving everybody the double talk and the con job, they're going to go buy it. But he's hitting a stone wall of resistance across America, including within his own party. You're not seeing it yet because his friends in the media are covering for him. That's why. You know, that's how I see it. Las Vegas. John, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
I'm honored, Dr. Savage. I have a comment. Coming from a non-practicing homosexual, that when I first heard the story about the newsman, that's exactly what I thought. And the issue I have is, since I'm a non-practicing homosexual because I gave up that lifestyle, I still have the urges, but hey, that's something that's my cross to bear, is that I can't say that, except on your show, without having the left coming up and attacking me. And I saw on Fox, I saw on the other stations, the report, and no one mentioned in Donnelly, hey, that doesn't make sense. He's got to be gay.
Wait, nobody mentioned that the ABC newsman was a homosexual?
No. And then when I listened to the story, I go, why aren't they...
Well, did they mention he was also a pedophile?
No, of course not. You're the only one who brought it up, sir.
Well, why should we cover up for the fact? Let people know reality. Maybe it'll save someone else's life who wants to give in to their worst impulses.
Instead of people, everybody has impulses. Instead of picking up and saying, no, I got to live a good lifestyle. I got to turn my life. I turn my life over to God. They'll rather make excuses, like you say, and try. Even my psychiatrist tells me to give in to them. I said, you're crazy.
Well, you're lucky you found a psychiatrist who was even willing to talk to you about suppressing any impulses, let alone a sexual impulse. Today, psychiatrists tell you to, if it feels good, do it. You want to eat a pound of chocolate cake, they'll tell you to eat it and take a Lipitor pill. Everything is a drug. So it's amazing you have a psychiatrist with any sense of morality at all.
Also, one last question, Dr. Savage. How does one go about getting that book that you were describing?
Which, my new autobiography?
Yes, sir.
Well, there's 200 copies left. I'm sending you one of them for free because you asked for it. That's all. Stay in the line. All right, look, we got a lot to talk about. And we haven't even touched on the con called the Carbon Con by Obama. You may not know about this story. I'm going to give you a little lead into it. Obama, or Giggles, is now trying to push through a system which will place severe government limits on the amount of carbon dioxide that companies will be permitted to emit in the name of reducing global warming. Okay, carbon caps, that's called. But what's just come out is that the very same Giggles, Obama, in fact, funded the same sort of carbon cap and trade program when he was a private citizen on the board of the leftist Joyce Foundation. His old friends are going to make a fortune on the carbon cap game. Now, during the Bush administration, we kept hearing no war for oil, no war for oil, no war for oil. And it was certainly true that Bush's cronies were profiting from government contracts in the war zone. There's no question about it. Then why should we not apply the same rules of no carbon for dollars? I'll be right back.
Savage.
No, there's another story I want to talk about. You see terrorist watch lists now. This came and went Monday that Obama, actually Bush started it in 2004, so-called fusion centers where they're mining intelligence on Americans who may be members of a strange group, and they're putting you in a pool with terrorists now. And that includes anyone who voted for Ron Paul, an anti-abortion activist. So I was thinking, wait a minute. Who else might they put into the fusion center under Janet Napolitano's Homeland Security? Would it be people who don't go to football games? Would they be suspect? After all, any white American male who doesn't go to a football game might be a member of a militia. How about people who refuse to watch American Idol on television? They're suspect. Maybe they should go into a fusion center watch list. Or how about people who don't go to Super Bowl parties or don't wear a game cap? How about non-golfers? What about people who don't golf or play tennis? According to the new Obama administration, maybe you'll be on a watch list as some oddball who should be looked after as a potential terrorist. This is getting crazier by the day. But again, I want to reiterate, it wasn't started by Obama. It was started by George Bush. He started it. He was the guy who started these fusion centers in which he was culling intelligence, so-called, by government sneaks and snoops about average Americans who didn't fit, you know, the mainstream image. So I should get worried about that too. What else should I worry about? From the New York Post, bottom left, tycoon says sex too rough for me. The lurid countess versus mogul smackdown on spooling in a Connecticut divorce court reached new lows yesterday. It's an interesting story about this 32-year-old contessa from Sweden. She's really gorgeous. So she married, she's a gold digger. She marries a 65-year-old guy. What do you expect? Oh, bingo. Now they're getting a divorce, and she's claiming the post-nup doesn't apply because they had sex after they got separated. So therefore, the post-nup is nullified. You hear this? Terrified by horny countess. What do you expect if you're 65 and you marry this kind of personality?
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Savage Nation. What month is this? I don't know the month of the year. March 25th, 2009. It's hard to keep track of time. Where? 15 years in radio. My God, where did the time go? Feels like yesterday. They said I wouldn't last 15 minutes, let alone 15 years. It just shows you what they know in the media. Play the music a little loud. That's it. So anyway, I mean, we're talking about a lot of stories. The main one is in no real order. ABC News reporter killed in rough trade, gay sex murder being covered up by his friends in the media, Obama's carbon con. And at the end, I got up to the a story from the New York Post. It's rather trivial, but it leads to another question. And that is, it's a countess from Sweden, 32 years old. She marries a 65-year-old American rich man, CEO of United Technologies, 66 years old. She's now 36. Now they're at a divorce trial, and they're accusing each other. And they claim that there was this and that, sleeping with each other. Now the lawyer's saying, did you sleep with her after you broke up? Because if you did, if you had sex, it means the post-nup has no validity. So he says, yes, we slept together, but there was no sex. You hear this? So no matter what these women get, I mean, she's already going to get, I think, $36 million no matter what happens. If the judge believes they reconciled, he may toss out an 05 post-nup, granting her a measly 600,000 shares of United Technology stock, currently worth $36 million. If the judge throws that out, this gold digger will grab more of this man's $329 million fortune, all for a little sex. You know, and this leads me to the conclusion that the post-nup always rings twice. And with the lawyers today, of course, the post-nup does always ring twice. But it leads me to another question about post-nups and prenups. And I'd like to ask you out there, I'm going to get off politics for a minute, although it's very political. Is there anyone listening to the show who has a pre- or post-nup horror story that you'd like to share with us here on the Savage Nation? The husband's side contends that the post-nup is rock solid and that she's being greedy and grabbing for any more of his hard-earned $321 million fortune. She always wants more, 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 complained the man's lawyer. Too much is never enough. In other words, she's a you-know-what. We won't even use the word. Assets of Madoff brother frozen. Oh, they finally got up to the brother? When are they going to get to the grandchildren? When did that come? Assets of Madoff brother. Yeah, Madoff brother. They didn't know what he was doing on the eighth floor. I'm going up now! What are you doing up there, Bernie? Never mind! You just run the business down from 7 to 1. We don't want to know what you're doing on the eighth floor, right? Never ask. Don't ask, don't tell. Jeez. The assets of Bernie Madoff's brother have been frozen. Good God. What about the grandchildren? Where are they? How'd they go to college? On whose money did they go to college? Ruthie and Bernie's money. Judge freezes Peter Madoff's assets. 5 public pension. What news? Obama seeks support for budget. What, is the guy crazy? No, he's just Giggles the Clown. He has no idea what he's talking about. I'm going to destroy the economy in order to save the economy. And after I save the economy, I'll destroy it in 2012 when I'm no longer in office. World president in trouble. Giggles is going to the big meeting, the G20, next week. And Giggles, they say, is in trouble before he gets there. Global recession and security challenges test Obama's popularity among world leaders. From France to Poland, from the Czech Republic to China, nations are rebuffing President Obama and offering little wiggle room for him to negotiate economic and security policies. That's fancy words to say they're onto the fact that he's a fraud. Remember 9 months ago he addressed an estimated 200,000 nuts in Germany, and he was declared the president of the world. Most of them were going to a rock concert. It was a setup by the media. They didn't tell you that. But okay, they made him the president of the world. But now that he's president of the United States, the world doesn't appear to be following up on its endorsement. They don't like what they see. They see a public relations disaster, according to a few people who are real watchers of what's going on. A top EU politician on Wednesday slammed Obama's plans for the U.S. to spend its way out of recession as a, quote, way to hell. Czech Prime Minister Mr. Topolánek said that Obama's massive stimulus package and banking bailout, quote, will undermine the stability of the global financial market, a way to hell. Amazing. Amazing. Just amazing to me what's going on with this guy. They're all they're slowly but surely coming to understand that they can criticize him without being called racist. That's what they're afraid of. It's all they're afraid of. They say one wrong word right away, the zingos in the media, racist, racist, racist. No one's calling on the post-nup, the prenup. Who cares? I threw it out there. The horror stories. What is this? Pirate yacht murder. I'm always interested in yacht murders. There's some horrible things going on out there with piracy. Oh, God, in Thailand. Thai police have charged 3 people over the attack on a British couple on their yacht in southern Thailand. Linda and Malcolm Robertson were on holiday off the southern province of Satun when the yacht was attacked. Mr. Robertson's throat was slit and his body thrown overboard, according to police captain Suparik Pangamakamakamakamananja. The 64-year-old's body has not yet been found. the three migrant workers were arrested as they try to flee in a dinghy taken from the Robinson's yacht. We are searching for the body, blah, blah, blah. What about the women? During the ordeal, Mrs. Robinson, 57, was apparently tied up naked like a trussed chicken and held hostage in the cabin for up to 10 hours. Ooh. Oh, boy. Her brother, John, who has spoken to her since the incident, said the robbers took her up on deck from time to time when they needed help sailing the yacht. At one point, she remembers walking in my husband's blood on the deck. I don't even want to read anymore. There's too many of these going on now. I would never sail in those seas, never. You got to be out of your mind to sail anywhere in the South China Sea or in that area. Just rampant with piracy. Piracy. Oh, we got a prenup, caller? And, of course, out of L.A. How do you like that? See, I knew eventually I could attract attention in Los Angeles if only I gave them what's important to people in Los Angeles. 1-800-449-8255. We're talking about everything under the sun, including this topic, which is prenup and postnup power stories. Because I still don't understand, if you sign a prenup, how does it get thrown out? What is the new trick of the shysters in the legal profession? Los Angeles, KGIL country. Mark, welcome to the Savage Nation.
I was definitely taken advantage of with a prenup agreement. I signed an agreement with my wife who had never earned a dime in her life before I married her. I was a stockbroker, and my commissions were approximately $1 million a year. However, I only got to keep about 45% of that.
Right.
And my agreement with her was that she would get about $100,000 a year afterwards if we got divorced. Well,
right.
Her attorney decided to value my business. They multiplied my $1 million a year total commissions times 20 years and said my business was worth $20 million and awarded her $10 million.
Well, wait, they never heard of income taxes in Los Angeles courts?
They didn't understand it. The attorneys didn't understand. The judges didn't understand. I was making 400 and some thousand a year, not $1 million.
So she was awarded $10 million, and did you actually have to pay it?
Well, unfortunately, I settled with her, and I got around it. I took advantage of it because I was supposed to give her a Mercedes, and I gave her my pension account, which she had to pay tax on everything she took out of it.
Good. I only hope that she suffered.
Well, the Mercedes, I took a loan against the house and bought the car.
I would have given her a Mercedes with a blown crankshaft, and a wheel should have fallen off on Highway 1.
She never made more than $10,000 in her life.
And where is she today? What, she become a lesbian?
No, she's single, living well.
Terrible. No, it's a horrible story what they do to men today in these courts. Horrible. A nightmare. But you're still laughing. I can tell you that something tells me you're still having a good time, Mark.
Well, I'm doing okay.
We don't want to know about it. Why is it that sex is so expensive in America? In other words, the guy falls in love. He sees stars in his eyes. It's only good for 90 days, that passionate hot sex, Mark. You know that.
I know that. No one has sex with their wife.
Well, no, 90 days is the maximum. 90, 91 days. It's been studied. This has been studied inside and out. 90 days of great sex, and that's about it. After that, the rest is a nightmare.
100% agreement with you.
Hey, before you go, Mark, because you're so good-natured, remember, were you listening to the time I told the story? I was in Newport. I think last spring, and I walked into a bar like the Rusty whatever, and there was this huge guy like a Hell's Angel in there with a T-shirt on, and the back of his T-shirt, he was laughing with his friends, he had a slogan on the back, and it said, "It's better to have loved and lost, ... than to have been married to a psychotic you-know-what for 38 years. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Why do fools fall in love?
Why do birds sing?
See? So, when this song came out, man, I still believed in everything. What a beautiful song. You remember this song? Does anyone raise your hand? Drag racing on the, who knows where, every highway in Queens. New York with the Hemi engine that blew up, hit by the side after making love to a Playboy bunny. One of these days I think I'll write my autobiography. It is the Savage Nation. Okay, stop the music. I have a real treat for you right now. You know, everybody wants to go behind the curtain. Everybody who's listening to this show wants to know something that the other, just something. There's a curiosity about who's this guy, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to disclose the name of the publication nor the individual, but I'm going to tell you that I'm going to read things to you right now that no other host in the history of the media would dare do. And that is a certain journalist who I don't really know, but he's got the bona fides for a major, major magazine, wants to meet me and do a profile on me. Now, I've had this before and I've been burned before. And so he wrote me about a month ago and I said, I'm not really, you know, ready to do it. Then I say to him, I send him back an email and I say, Michael Savage here, how do you want to proceed? Let's email for a bit. I'm not ready to meet you. I've been lied to and set up before, most notably by every magazine and newspaper writer who I've ever befriended. I guess I'm just a trusting personality who wants to believe in people. So that's what I said to him. So then he, about a couple of days ago, sends me an email on the 19th, and it says, hi. Sounds fine. I understand completely. I've been doing this long enough to know you can't promise anyone that they will like what you write about them. He says, but I can say that I have no interest in writing a story that reads like an expose. That's been done anyway. Reporters sometimes act as if your expertise in herbal medicine and your upbringing in the Bronx were deep, dark secrets, even though you regularly talk about both on the air. So now here's a guy who actually listens to this show. So he goes on and he says, what hasn't been done is a story explaining what makes your show different from all the others and much more unpredictable. At a time when Rush is getting a lot more attention, I think people might be interested to hear the story of a radio host who also belongs to another tradition. As a listener and a writer, I'm also curious about how it all fits together. You're passionate about the political issues of the day, but also interested in the bigger philosophical questions. The other day you said, that's why we're focused on politics, to make believe we don't care about the eternal questions. So he hears me. Then he says, part of what I want to know is how your perspective on both has or hasn't shifted over the years. Okay, so I let that sit for a few days. I didn't say anything. I forgot. I was too busy. Sends me another note today and it says, hi, I hope I'm not bugging you. I'd still love to talk, or if you prefer, answer whatever questions you might have when you get a minute. Again, I'm not going to expose the publication. So I sent him back an email that was ambiguous this morning and it goes like this. What is your orientation here? What is it that you're after? Every other journalist, London Times, etc., told me they'd be fair. They never mentioned my 20 books and ethnobotanical research, my grants to Marines and cops, and so on. All they wrote about was their own biases. How can I help you? I decided that I can't really open myself up one more time. So I got this a minute ago, and I'm going to read it to you, and I'm going to ask you, should I meet with this reporter or not? This is going to be an interactive interview. No one's ever done anything like this. You're going to play a role as to whether I should do this interview or not. Again, I will retain the anonymity of the reporter and the publication. I will do that. Listen to what the man writes back. He says, obviously a journalist promising to be fair is a bit like a doctor promising to be gentle. It sounds good, but it doesn't mean much. But I will say that I've got no interest in writing one of those pieces that's all about whether some outspoken person is good or bad or hateful or whatever. Like I said, that's been done more than once. By this point, it feels kind of old. I agree with him. And it's not what I do anyway. I'm pretty difficult to shock or offend. There are plenty of people on the radio who disagree with Nancy Pelosi, but there's no one who does a show like yours. The storytelling, the unexpected references to Lawrence Stern and Martin Buber, the meditations on life and death, the digressions, etc. And yet I've never read a mainstream profile of you that captures all that. In fact, I'm not sure I've ever read a mainstream profile of you written by someone who actually listens to your show for fun. So in that way, at least this could be a first. I'm not going to pretend that blank, his magazine, is known as a conservative magazine. But in a sense, you're exactly the kind of person our readers should be interested in. A colorful guy from New York with lots of stories to tell. Can we give it a shot? Should I do the interview or not? Do you trust this reporter or don't you? Will it be another hit piece? Because every one of them, this guy's smarter than almost all of them. This guy's a better writer than almost all of them. This guy actually listens to me than all of them. Now, I had the guy from the London Times come out and he stabbed me in the back. I mean, I took him to dinner down in Alioto's, had a nice time. He goes back to London. All it was about is I'm a homophobe. The guy flies all the way from London to write an article for his friends. That was the whole thing he got out of it. All right, so what am I going to do? Then there's another creep from a local magazine, again, my best friend, and he puts something out with me foaming at the mouth with spittle coming out of my mouth that I'm a maniac. All right, whatever. They'll be out of business, and I'll still be on the air. I've been in the business 15 years, and what I pay in tips, this guy doesn't make in a whole year, this guy who wrote that article. So it doesn't matter to me. I have to be a little arrogant to protect myself, but I'm asking you, should I do this interview or not? I'm going to take a few calls on this. I want to know. You heard, you read, you listened, now report.
Savage.
Beyond the sea. So I'm going to take your calls on whether or not to do this interview with this mainstream publication. And by the way, I've read it most of my life. I grew up reading it. I mean, it's a little too liberal for my taste these days, but it's well written generally. But I still don't trust anybody in the journalist profession. Now, before I go to your calls on whether to take it or not, I have to go back to my opening statement of today, which is that I'm usually right about everything on this show, such as I predicted that the ABC newsman, it was a rough trade job. I mean, I can read it. What did I say to you yesterday? What did I say to you last week? What did I say to you last month? What did I say to you? Who's running the world's economy? Did I not say George Soros? Did I not say he's the one who put Obama in power? Did I not tell you he's made a fortune? Just came out. I'm having a very good crisis, says Soros, as hedge fund managers make billions off recession. George Soros, who predicted the global financial crisis twice before, i.e. he caused it, was one of the few people to anticipate and prepare for the current economic collapse. In other words, he anticipated? Are you crazy? Soros said his prediction meant he was better able to brace his quantum investment fund against the global storm. Came out of retirement in 07, he made $2.9 billion. And while the financial crisis continued to deepen across the globe, the 78-year-old puppet master still managed to make $1.1 billion last year. In a way, it is the culminating point of my life's work, he told the national newspaper, The Australian. So as I told you, this crisis is being manipulated at the top by money managers. And if you think that Obama won the presidency because he was such a great human being and he cured polio, you're mistaken. These money managers put him in power. They put this puppet in power. And Giggles the Clown right now is doing everything that they want done so that they can continue to benefit from the economic downturn around the world. That's my estimation. That's my opinion. Take it for what it's worth. Now let's go to the callers on should I do or not do the interview. New York City, WOR, Michael, yes or no, should I do the interview?
Michael.
Yes.
Yes, you should do the interview.
Why?
Well, how many conservatives are there on the radio that can wax rhapsodic about John Coltrane, Michael?
None.
Exactly.
Yeah, look, Michael, listen, I understand all of that, but how much of that you think will really wind up in this article? You know and I know it's only going to be about the gay movement. That's all it's going to come down to. They're obsessed with this, people in the writing world. That's all they write about.
I think you should give it a shot. Conservatives are more complicated than they make us out to be, and you're a perfect example of that.
That's exactly right, and they want stereotypes. They want a fat white male who is balding, who lives in Florida, and doesn't have a wife, only a cat. I'm allergic to cats. I have a dog. It was sad. I was bicycling today down at the mall. I'm a sentimental guy. I really am. I'm getting older. I'm even more sentimental. I'm not as hard as you think. I'm bicycling. So there was a nice couple with two Shelties. I have a poodle right now, a toy poodle, as you know. So I had a Sheltie before named Snowy. I love this animal. 11 years, she gave me such joy. Then she got sick, and they said, gas her. I said, I'll gas you first. People were telling me, put her to sleep. I said, I'll put you to sleep first. I hate when people say, you put her to sleep. She wasn't dying. She was hobbling. She was a little, arthritic. We found a nice couple with a ranchette up in Sonoma. They took her in. She became a part of their family. And she lived another 2 good years. And I saw when the light went out of her eyes, I saw the last day. I mean, look, it's like a person. And what the strange part is that she died around the time that my mother passed away. It was almost as though this dog lived to give me a precursor, a premonition of what was coming. I mean, I've seen it through animals before, but nevertheless, I don't want to go in. So I'm down at the mall, and they have like a bigger Sheltie and a little Sheltie. And these dogs, little lassies, So she brought back this whole sweetness. The eyes are like that of a doe. And the most beautiful personality you've ever seen. So I said to them nicely, may I say hello to your dog? You know, dog lovers are generally nice people. Unless they're Michael Vick and they put him into a pit to be ripped apart. But we won't go into that. It's a nice moment, but, you know, brings up the whole thing, which is the way of all flesh. And that's all there is to it, you know, the old boxeroo waiting at the end of the road for all of us. The mausoleum versus the ground versus you still don't want to believe. No one wants to believe it's real. You really actually believe it? You actually walk around thinking it's going to happen to you? Nobody does. Would you believe that a man like Soros would be walking the earth? A monster like this would still be around? Broke the British pound, broke the Malaysian pound, stimulated anti-Semitism around the world, hates America, stabbed the country in the heart. I mean, it's like the man is like Dr. Death to me. And here he is. He creates Stalinist fascist organizations like Media Matters and puts a charlatan into the presidency. And it tries to muffle Michael Savage, Rush, the cat lover, and others. And this Stalinist is now held up as a great genius. See if that would wind up in the interview. I can guarantee you it wouldn't. That I can guarantee you. You know what I really, I tell you, the guy says he listens to the show. Now, here's something I'm going to do. You want to talk about walking on the high wire without a net? This gentleman, this reporter, is probably just listening to the show right now. I am going to invite him to call the show without identifying himself. He does not have to identify his name or his publication. But if he wants to come on this show, and he wants to tell the audience that I should trust him, I'm going to make this the most interactive mainstream interview ever done in American journalistic history. You know, this could make news unto itself. This is a way to save the magazines. Do you realize what I'm doing right now is I'm throwing a life preserver out to a magazine that deserves to be saved, incidentally? I don't have to agree with their politics to understand that there's room in the world for really interesting articles and magazines. Certainly, I grew up on them. I didn't grow up on the computer. I grew up on newspapers and magazines, you know, and certainly a lot of books. But the point is, why don't we change the dynamics of the entire situation? Instead of a journalist saying, "Will you do the interview?" and I'm saying I'm hesitant, and he's saying, "I can't say I'm a nice guy, but I blah blah blah," and I'm saying, "You should I do it or not?" Why shouldn't this guy come on the show without identifying himself and have a conversation with me, and then the audience decides in a vote whether I should do the interview or not? I think that's a dynamic, phenomenal idea. Moreover, I'll go a step further. If I did do the interview after the guy comes on here, just think about how many of you would buy that magazine just to have a couple of new pictures of me. No, I'm serious. This is amazing. So I'm going to throw it out to the journalist. You don't have to do it right now, but whatever. So I'm going to take your calls on this, yes or no. Tucson, Jenny, go ahead, please. Yes or no?
No. He's just going to mix a little bit of truth with a little bit of lies and make you look pretty bad. He's going to try to do a psychological assessment. Don't do it. Do not do it.
Wow. Okay, that's woman's intuition. She says no. Houston, Mike, your opinion, please.
Yes, I say do it. And I'll tell you why. He didn't throw a bunch of empty promises at you. He sounds honest. He listens to the show. He sounds like he's expansive enough to get you.
But, Mike, I had this twice before from two other so-called journalists. One flew all the way from London on almost the same premise. Now, he did not really listen to the show. He didn't quite get me before he got here. But all he wrote about when he went back was homophobia. That's all that was on his mind from the day he left the London gay bath that he obviously bathed in.
Well, if he wants to pigeonhole you, that's a problem. And how can one interview or one article do you justice? I don't understand that. However, it almost sounded in the few emails that you read that you were writing to yourself. It sounds
No, it's
like
interesting. Yes, no, his emails are so interesting that I read them on the air. I mean, this is a pretty amazing show when you think about it. I thought my more intelligent listeners would be interested in knowing what goes on sometimes behind the scenes. The guy sounds smart, but then again, I'm sure he has to answer to someone else. And I'll tell you something else. This man could write a fabulous article about me, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you a name in a minute. He could come out here intending to do a hit piece and realize that I'm really an interesting guy and a decent man, kind-hearted man, very intelligent, and write a fabulous article about me, and his editor could kill it or destroy the article. And I'm going to tell you who did this to me once before. He's now some famous reporter. I think his name is Tapper. Isn't there a Jake Tapper? Isn't he with ABC? Jake Tapper came out to interview me 10 years ago when he, I think it was him writing for Newsweek. I could be mistaken. And I'll take it back if I am mistaken, but I won't take it back if I'm not. He came out to write a negative piece on me for Newsweek. He came out instead and wrote a positive story about me because he liked me, because he's an honest journalist. And the story was killed by Newsweek because it did not destroy my image for the vermin who write Newsweek. Now, of course, look, the truth is they're going out of business, Newsweek, and I'm still thriving. That's the bottom line here. The reality is I just spoke with one of the people who run the syndication companies. My show is actually bigger than it was last year. My AQH is up. My audience is up. My affiliates have gotten stronger in some markets. So it's not like I'm begging for publicity. But everybody has vanity. Everybody has an ego. Everybody wants their true story told. Nobody wants to be typecast and miscast. Nobody does. And there's not been one article ever written about me in a mainstream publication that was ever honest. All of them were written by stinkers. Zach in Los Angeles, your opinion. Go ahead, please.
Mike, please do it. Yeah. I'm begging you to do it.
Why? Why?
Mike, you have no idea. I mean, I'm sorry to say this. I don't mean to sound silly, but I've never been starstruck. I never thought I would be starstruck over a talk radio host. Man, I need you to do it for my own entertainment. Please.
That's nice to hear. Okay, even if it's for entertainment, I don't really mind. It doesn't bother me. I think entertainment has a great role in society. And I think the greatest kind of entertainment is entertainment that educates. So I appreciate that. In the beginning, I used to bristle when someone said you're just an entertainer. Now it's a great compliment. You know, how many boring teachers have you had in your life that you fell asleep with, right? You know who the best teacher I ever had was? I got to tell you a teacher story for fun. To show you the difference between a good teacher and a bad one. I remember I went into the seventh grade. I skipped the grade. I went into so-called SP Parsons Junior High School in Queens. It was a brand new white brick building. It was not one of those things that looked like a crematoria that they had all over the city at that time. You couldn't tell the difference between a reform school, a mental hospital, or a public school. They all looked the same. This place was white brick, and they built it specially for all the kids that grew up at that time. And they had a thing called SP, Special Progress, where you skipped the eighth grade and you did seventh and ninth. Now, I was young to begin with, and I was on the smaller side. I wasn't a big kid. So I looked much younger than I actually was on top of it all. So I go into the seventh grade, and I'm in the science class. I don't remember the teacher's name. And I'm falling asleep. I was a dreamer even then. My mind would drift. I couldn't listen. I couldn't sit in the chair. You know, I sometimes ride by elementary schools today on a bicycle, and I look in as I'm passing by, and I see poor little children sitting crumpled up in chairs with a poor teacher with chalk on a blackboard, and I say, my God, nothing's changed since Greek times. They're still using chalk on a blackboard with 30 bored students sitting in hard chairs. How in the heck can anyone learn in that environment? So anyway, I'm sitting on a hard chair in Parsons Junior High School. I must have been 13. I don't remember how old I was, 12, 13. And I'm bored. And I remember to this day, it was late in the year. It was like already June and hot. And I wanted to go to like the beach or the mountains, something. I didn't want to be there anymore. And the teacher saw the kids were drifting off. And he's mumbling. Blah, 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 blah. All of a sudden, I used to sit in the back row so I could goof around. I hear a bang behind my head. I jumped like somebody had dropped a bomb in the room. And he says, well, that's an example of what a vacuum can do. What he did was, is he took a piece of Tupperware, he filled it with water, he lifted the lid and let the air out, created a little vacuum, and then he threw it against the back lockers, the clothing lockers, and it didn't burst open with water. And he said, that's what a vacuum can do. Now, that's an example of teaching. That's the kind of teacher that I really admired. I've had a few others along the way, along the years. They're few and far between, this kind of gifted teacher. And I try to bring the very same techniques to my classroom, the Savage Nation. I shall return.
Savage.
God, here we are again in that ether. That ether, that rare ether that can only be created by the genius. Well, anyway, go try to do this on radio every day. You ever try to sound like Coltrane on the saxophone in his best pieces? Impossible. Lucky for you, I don't use drugs. I would have been dead 30 years ago. Anyway, you know, when this show ends tonight, I'll tell you what I'm going to do is I'm probably going to go out on my boat. It's a hot night out in the Bay Area. The weather changes like spring. It's staying light late. I'm just going to go out alone on my little boat and probably play either. Hey, you know the music I like the most lately is that Skip Henderson, Billy Bones. I love that song. It's got such a darkness to it. Billy, I can make that group famous, whatever.
Bones,
Billy Bones.
Davy Jones.
And gold and wenches bold. I like that part, the wenches bold. It's about semen songs. It's so great. Rum and gold and wenches bold.
Good morning to you, Billy
you,
Bones.
You, Billy Bones, Billy Bones. Good morning to you, darling Billy. I love these songs because they're filled with, it's about life and death. And it makes you kind of laugh at it all at a certain point. Anywho, let's go to Dane in Florida. Dane, welcome to the Savage Nation. Should I do the interview or not?
Yes, absolutely. And I'll tell you why. Because I think you should do it interactively on your show. You do the whole thing right on the show. And then
bingo! Dane, it's genius! We could actually create a new medium, which is interviewing a radio host on the air over a series of days, and then the article comes out, and the listeners actually are involved in this.
Absolutely. Interactive. There you go. You're the best.
You know, Dane, truthfully, nobody will have ever done this. I don't know if anyone has ever done this, by the way, in journalistic history. It would be a trend-setting. It's unbelievable what you just came up with, Dane, because if this were to occur, the reporter would create a fame for himself, and I think the people listening to the show, a lot of you will go and buy the magazine because you will have been participatory in it.
It can change the magazine industry and we'll know the truth. We'll know the truth.
Well, you see, Dane, I'm glad you said that we'll know the truth because many of these interviews, I've said to the reporters, I would like to run a tape recorder of your interview of me. Your questions, my actual answers, and then I want my listeners to let me play these tapes once your article comes out, and they all said no. Every one of them said no.
There you go.
Dane, I'm going to send you a free copy of Psychological Nudity because that was so good. That was so good. That was so smart. Las Vegas Mike, your opinion, please.
Yeah, hi. I don't think you should. I think you don't need it. You're in the catbird seat. I think you're sort of reacting like every human being does. You know, you're flirting with being stroked a little bit because when you're in a catbird seat, there were fewer people who were able to stroke you to start with. And you sort of get a little bit googie-eyed when someone does, and you're flirting with a little. You don't need it. You know what I mean?
You know, you're a very, very sober man. You almost sound like a pilot to me. What do you do for a living, Mike?
I was a salesman.
Well, you could have been a pilot. No, well, I'm saying a guy like you probably has been underestimated all of his life. You have a pretty eagle's view of the world, don't you?
Yeah, fairly good. I have a fairly good view.
Yeah. I really appreciate your viewpoint. It was very nice, very brotherly. So I don't think I'll do it now. It was like I was talking to my father with that guy. I got scared for a minute. Oh, look, Mike, you're in the catbird seat. You know, you're flirting with this guy. That was like my father came back to haunt me. What do you need it for? I could always hear him. Yeah, let me see, what would Dad say now that I think about it? Dad, come in. I actually keep a picture of my lovely father right over me here in the studio. Undershirt, Catskill Mountains, happy. Next to Fats Domino up there. No undershirt, but happy. You know that for years, let me tell you a little story. Oh, my God, I'm out of time for this hour already. For years after my father died, because he died when I was young, I mean, never met my first child, and blah, 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 I would actually talk to him every time I had to make a decision. I would say, Dad, what should I do? And do you know that I got answers? I would get answers from him. Now, is that real? I mean, is it fiction of my own mind? What do we know? What do we know about these things?
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I am a food expert. Let's say everyone is a food expert for what they like. That is true. But I am actually a real expert. I detest fancy restaurants because the food is phony. I only eat in cheap restaurants because there the food is generally, it has to be better because the people don't have money. And they know the difference and they're going to walk out unless the food is good. But anyway, to make a long story short, I have lived in Northern California forever. Now, I'm not one of these bagel and lox guys. I don't eat cream cheese, but I do like smoked salmon. Now, you would think that in Northern California, where you have such snobs about food and salmon, they're all concerned about the salmon and it's not growing and you can't fish. You can't get smoked salmon that doesn't taste disgusting in San Francisco. It tastes so smoked you can't eat it. Everything is overdone. They smoke it to the point where I go in delis there. Fine, give me some salmon, but I don't want a smoky flavor. They look at you like you committed a crime. Well, isn't that the object? So a bunch of schmucks came out there from Oklahoma, like, and then they invented the no food, you know, because minimalist and bad wine already. They're experts. You come to Southern Florida, where the people look like they were on the moon for the last several generations. They're all very short and squat with, like, faces that are like blown up from too much sun. I don't know what it is, seltzer, salt, genetics. They're generally nice people. They're benign. They're the type that Madoff took advantage of. They think they know everything, and they're basically sheep. They're like a herd mentality. But one thing they know is lox. I don't know how they know it, but that they know. Politics, they know nothing. They don't know who to vote for. They think Sean Penn is a wonderful guy, even though he hates Jews in Israel. They're that kind of people. But they know lox. I go in a deli and I ordered half a pound of Novalox, which is smoked salmon, of course, for those of you who are not from areas where it's called lox. You think it's liquid oxygen for setting off a rocket, but no, smoked salmon, and thin sliced. Now, you try to get it thin sliced in San Francisco, they'll throw you out. They don't know what you're talking about. And I'll tell you another giveaway. The way they present it here, it's flat. They roll it and you unroll it, it comes out perfect. In San Francisco, they'll take a luncheon meat, if you say to them, sliced turkey, give me a pound of sliced turkey. They crush it up and they roll it and throw it in a bag. It looks like cat turd by the time you get it home. And they think they're experts on everything. You hear this? No wonder the HIV rate is high in Washington, D.C. Now you say, what does the quality of lox in Southern Florida have to do with the HIV rate in Washington? Everything and nothing. Because these people know nothing about anything except lox. They'll keep electing officials who keep letting people into the country with diseases like AIDS. You understand that? And they'll keep going to movies and supporting people who are basically committing suicide for the country and for them. But they know lox. The important thing is that they're nice people. They're basically benign. I have Teddy with me. So I was walking around with it. Do you want to hear any of this? You want me to get back to AIG and this? Sanctuary, cops, Acorn. I don't care about Acorn. Kerry, prosecute. I don't care. I think I'm not doing politics for a while. I'm on strike. I told you I think I'm on strike because you've heard it all. By the time this time of the day rolls around, you have heard everything you need to know about the world and more. And the only reason you're listening to me is because I've done it differently, better, stronger, angrier, more intelligent, more intellectual, a higher IQ. But There's only so much you want to hear about him being a socialist, a Marxist, a communist. Even though it's all true, there's no point anymore. It's done. It's a done deal. The Italians have had a communist party for 75 years. We're the only country that pretends communist? Me? No. Obama, socialist? No. What? Incredible. We don't have a socialist communist party. You got a socialist slash communist party running the country right now. You're acting shocked. You don't know what's going on. In Italy, they've had one for years. They have the far left parties in England, have them in France, they have them in Germany, but never heard of them here. Oh, they're Democrats. The Lux people don't know that they're communist socialists. If they knew they were communist socialists, they would jump off a bridge because they take away their condominiums from them and force them to put illegal aliens in their bathtub.
Savage.
I'll go to a food thing now. People like that segment, but it's true because it's real. I go to my favorite Chinese, the one that doesn't feel like I just ate crazy glue when I leave. You know what I'm saying? That's how I judge Chinese restaurants. Either it's either a CG or a non-CG. Not MSG anymore. It's crazy glue. Because the real bad ones, you walk out, your lips stick together, you start to talk like Bonnie Tang. The average Chinese restaurant you leave today, because you get to sound like Bonnie Tang. So I go to my favorite place where it's not like a crazy glue sauce. And the food was excellent, but I noticed something. If I order the seafood clay pot in this place, which I did, they cut back on the seafood by the number of shrimp, and they added tofu, which I hate. I can't stand fried tofu. I hate it. I don't like tofu to begin with. What's with the tofu? The reason they ate tofu is they didn't have meat. What do you think they ate tofu for a million years in China? Or 2,000, 5,000? What do you think is better for you? You believe that baloney? The rich ones ate meat when they can get their hands on it, or a duck or a fish. It was the poor, the peasants in the field, you let them eat tofu. So now I have to engage myself. Like, the point is, though, they're cutting back on the protein. I went to another place, a cheaper Chinese restaurant, local. And, there's another, the dim sum that I ordered before the meal. Normally it was four pieces in an order, now it was three. I said, wait a minute, am I imagining? Because if you're eating with someone, you get two each. So now you each have one, and already I'm a fast eater. I want the next one before the person I'm eating with already ate the first. I want the third. And it's gone. You don't know what to do. You can't split a dim sum in half. It sticks to the chopstick. What I'm getting at is they're cutting back. It's like three-quarter value now. So I'm cooking at home more. In fact, I had fun this morning. I bicycled to a food implement store, like these fancy stores that won't be in business soon, with stuff that nobody needs, you know, kitchen items that nobody wants or needs. My mother had a kitchen with a few pots in it and pans with four burners, an electric stove, in a tiny kitchen. In fact, you can see a picture of it in a previous book of mine. She could knock out five restaurant meals for one at one sitting on those little electric burners with aluminum pots. And wonderful, incredible meals, complicated. Today you go into a house, a $10 million kitchen that's never been cooked in. Never been. In fact, if someone cooked in it, they might have to renovate the kitchen. The average house in Tiburon, California, are you kidding me? Huh. What are you kidding? We don't cook in here. We just do freebase in here. Yeah. So the point is, I'm cooking at home. So I go to this food implement store, and I bought something for myself that I've wanted for 20 years. It's not that it's expensive. It's just that I haven't gotten around to it. You know what it is? Funny. It's like a kitchen weight, a cast iron weight that you put on top of a piece of chicken or a hamburger, so while it's cooking, the fat goes out of it. You know what I'm talking about? I've always wanted one. To me, that was like a cooking advanced cooking, to have one of those. Anyone had like a kitchen weight? Because ever since I was a kid in Queens, if I would go to the luncheonette for a hamburger for lunch, I have to make this admission. I did have hamburgers at one point in my life. I know it's a crime against BO's administration. But they'd always have like on the griddle the weight to push the fat out into the... So I bought one of those, and to go with it, then there was an Italian thing that they were selling on the same order that was not cast iron. It was like 10 pounds, a circle of stainless steel, and it was like an Italian. They couldn't sell them, though. Everyone wanted the small guy. It's a big round one that you sit on top. You put it on top of two steaks or on top of a chicken. You can make mate chicken, which is unbelievable. You cook in the weight, and then as it's cooking, the fat runs out. So I bought those things. They're in the boxes and the plastic, and I'll never use them. But I did it because I actually am starting to cook home more and more. I'll give you three reasons why I'm cooking home more and more. A, I hate driving. B, living in the Bay Area, I cannot stand listening to the drivel coming out of the mouths of moronic liberals. See, I don't want to hear the word Obama while I'm eating. I want to puke. I can't. I start to boil. I don't want to hear it. D, they're cutting back on the good protein. E, I don't know whether they're using melamine in some of the protein. D, I don't know how much of the produce or the garlic comes from China. I tend to buy only local. Northern California produced everything from garlic to onions to carrots. It's got to be organic. I will not buy any vegetable that's not noted. Its country of origin is not known. And restaurants, I don't know where it's, they don't know where it's coming from at all. And so you don't have to drive. You can drink more. And plus, it's more interesting to eat at home. Why is it more interesting? I could watch a movie or I could watch nothing. I could sit in silence. Who says you have to talk during a meal? You know, it's another thing I don't understand. Why do people scream in certain restaurants? There's a fish joint in San Francisco that's actually, it's been around forever. It's on California Street. I don't even remember the name of it. Very famous, mainly tourists and like people who went to dumb schools like Harvard and Yale and prep schools, the way they learned to be morons and rob people. People without a conscience and without a soul basically go in there with bow ties. I've lived here for, I don't know how many years, 74, 84, over 30 years living in Gomorrah here, Sodom and Gomorrah. I've always walked past it. I've always looked in, and it always looks like a Good Time Charlie fish restaurant, like a New York fish house. But I don't go in because every time I do, it's so noisy, the noise blows you out of the door. But I ate there last week. It was good, except the noise was horrible. So I had to take the food home halfway through the meal. The question is, why do people scream in restaurants? Grown-ups. Is this an example of like children who grew up without any parental controls? Am I looking at this now? It must be, like people in their 40s, now that I think about it. They were raised by hippie parents, and they don't understand you don't have to scream in a restaurant. Who knows? What am I talking about here? What's the difference? But how come my mother could cook so well on four electric burners and a little stove with aluminum foil underneath the... She put aluminum foil underneath the electric grate so it wouldn't stain the stove. You hear this? She had to preserve a stove that must have cost $92. But when you went in that woman's house, the little refrigerator, you couldn't walk past the stove, by the way. If she was cooking the little pantry kitchen, it was an embarrassment. Because do I have to spell it out for you the way people kiss in Northern California, the Marin kiss with the hips back in case someone should mistake with the... So to walk through the kitchen while your mother was cooking was an impossibility. It was the same with the dining room. The dining room was so small. God bless her. When she opened that up for Thanksgiving and you had 12 people around it, you risked a hernia, a rupture. You didn't know what you were going to get if you're walking with the objects from the hi-fi, they called there, with the pointy ends on the hi-fi. The blonde furniture came in. A point on it could emasculate you just going for the appetizer. You had to find a way to step over things to get around the people sitting at the table to go to the... Boy, do I miss it. I miss it because now you wind up alone with a TV tray watching Wolf Blitzer with a takeout turkey.
Savage.
One 800 449 8255. Relatives, please don't call. No, I don't have any relatives who listen to the show. Apparently, I never hear about anyone I know who listens to it. They all make believe they don't listen to the show. It's terrible when you're famous in a family, and they get mad at you for your success. They would rather that you're a junkie in a rehab than. I know a guy who has a brother. He's a talk show host. I don't really know him personally, but he's not a bad guy. He's on another station. He's very liberal. When I used to be on a station, he's a nice guy. He has a brother who's a junkie. And this guy knows exactly what it's all about. If I were, let's say, a junkie in rehab and amounted to nothing in my life, the relatives would love me. Oh, look at that poor Michael and never got anywhere. How terrible. Let me see if I can help him. But if you're successful, they don't want to know you. It's a law of reversal here. All your life you strive to achieve something, and when you do, you write your first book. Oh, yeah, really? No kidding. I like Stephen King. That was what I heard the first book I published 30 years ago. And my book was really a fine book, and it went very far. Earth Medicine, Earth Foods, 1972. I was so proud of myself. And may he rest in peace. I swear to God, I brought it into my father's market. I think my father was dead already. He had died so young. But a relative was still living, who I love to this day. I have nothing against him. I show him the book. I traveled all, like, 6,000 miles. Have you seen my new book, Uncle? Yeah. He said, how much do you make a book? He looked at it like a piece of herring. He opened it up. He said, how much do you make a book? You make $1 a book. I couldn't believe what I'd heard. Everything was dollars and cents. It wasn't that way for me. Well, at least then it wasn't. I mean, things have changed for me now a little bit more, but I'm almost going back to the way I was then. It's not all about the money. There are certain things in life that transmute dollar value, like children, like having children, like raising children, and seeing the next generation emerge. And I want to talk about children. I got 2 minutes here. Because a young man called earlier, and he asked me to talk about children. Suddenly, I'm the resident expert on children. But you know what? I'm as good as any, because I have children who are adults, and they're both wonderful people and fine people. And the fact of the matter is, I'm as good an expert as any. I have found in my life that most of the PhD experts on children are either gay or crazy and were never married. Or if they were married, they either tried to kill their wife or were in rehab for a few years and then came out and went into psychotherapy to find out why they killed or attempted to kill. And then they washed it all away and suddenly they're experts on child rearing. I mean, I'll tell you, that's what I found. So I'm as good a source as any on how to raise a child. You want to hear the number one rule? It's really simple. I remember when I had my first child. I had been living in the islands at that time. I flew all the way home, 6,000 miles where my father died, to the funeral. And I took my little baby with us. I mean, you know, it was like an infant. It was terrible. I had a reason to come home to that. But you can't pick things in life. Things happen. So after you go to the house and you drink and we're sitting and talking. I remember asking one of my uncles, who incidentally did not have children himself, but he was not a bad guy. Somehow I loved him and I thought he knew everything. But he never had kids himself. So I said, well, really, I don't know the rules. How do you raise a child? What are you supposed to do? I didn't know how to raise a child. What do you think, you know? I didn't know. I was not a baby. I mean, I was like 28 at the time, but it was still, by today's standards, I mean, it was like an infant. They don't have children today till they're 60 in Los Angeles. The guy is bald. He's got one foot in the earth, and he marries his masseuse or his Viagra provider. And then they have a baby, and the baby is 12 when he drops dead. I don't know how these kids are all going to survive with these fathers 60 years. All right, that's a second story. So I asked my uncle, well, how do you raise your child? I mean, what's the rules here? My uncle said something to me that I remember to this day. He said, you know what? There are no rules except one that you have to remember. Love them. If you love them, everything will work out. And you know something? He was right. I don't mean unconditional love, like if they smear fecal matter on the wall, you say, what a wonderful piece of art. We're not talking about that. We are talking about genuine love, which entails parameters of behavior that are acceptable.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Now, let me talk about my dog for a minute. Because it's a very interesting thing. If you see the world through the eyes of a dog, you could see an awful lot of the world that you normally wouldn't see. And I went for a walk downtown, in the downtown, as people were boarding buses and running to the underground and getting in cars to go home. At about 6:15, 6:30, I walked around the streets of downtown San Francisco for the first time with my little dog. Now, he's a small dog. He's a 9-pound toy poodle. And I noticed something peculiar. Not that he peed on over 50 to 100 items in that 30-minute walk. That unto itself is a biological phenomenon that I don't understand. I don't know if there's sufficient liquid in his body to have covered all of the garbage cans, telephone poles, bushes, etc., in that short radius, but somehow he manages to muster even more fluid just when you think it's impossible. It's like watching a high wire act that you say can't go further, and it goes further. So to make a long story short, I'm walking little Teddy around, and I'm watching the people go home. It's one of the things I enjoy doing. I like the hustle and bustle of a city. I go berserk if I stay in the suburbs too long. I go berserk, totally berserk. So I watch the people coming and going. I watch them going into the bars. I enjoy watching people relieving tension by having a few drinks after work in the upscale bars downtown. I like the boys and the girls talking, the men and the women, et cetera. The car's coming, the car's going. And I generally just enjoy being alive and feeling the fog on my face and hearing the hustle and bustle of a city at the end of a day's work. But I noticed something as I walked little Teddy around the streets of downtown San Francisco after the radio show last night, which is how few people even noticed there was a little dog in the street. how many of them were like robotic. Now, I got to tell you something. A little dog like this is not a common sight in San Francisco. In fact, what's amazing is how few dogs you ever see in the downtown area of San Francisco at all. There are dogs in San Francisco, but they're generally not in the work district. That's not 100% true in other cities. In some cities, you actually see animals downtown. But let's just put that aside for a minute. You don't see dogs there too often. You don't see a cute little dog like this. The point I'm getting at is that people are like automatons. They don't notice them. Now I'm going to ask you a question. What kind of person, race and ethnicity sex, do you think, A, noticed this dog more frequently than the general population, and B, of those who noticed the dog, who smiled the most? This is a small, unscientific sample of downtown San Francisco from which we can generalize if we choose to, which we will. Because I find that generalizing from subjective observations is as valid as generalizing from objective generalizations, observations. What did I just say? Anyway, the question is, who do you think smiled at the dog the most? And who do you think didn't even notice the dog the most? Racially, no. Which race? And B, why am I asking you this question? Answer, because I refuse to talk about Democrats and Republicans. Absolutely refuse, will not do it. Not my cup of tea. Now, if you're offended at me, I can understand it. And you can call me if you're offended. But I'm going to talk more about dogs and a movie I saw last night on The Savage Nation. Or if you're bored of those topics, I can talk about the care of old clocks, because I collect old clocks. And many of you don't understand how incredibly wonderful it is to have a pendulum clock that's over 100 years old that still runs properly. And to wind it once a week and to hear a tick and to make sure that it's running properly is an amazing relaxation for me. I know, don't get me wrong, it's not the cure for anything. It's just a hobby of mine. Sacramento, Tom, you're on the Savage Nation.
Yeah, Dr. Savage, I definitely think that Caucasian young females would like the dogs the most. No question about it. They still have
them. Well, that's very interesting. Yes, the dog is a chick magnate, That's funny. I'm sure he's a chick magnate for other small toy poodle girls, but he is a chick magnet, but that's not what I use him for, because I'm not in that category of operations at this stage of my life. But they were not the number one group that smiled at Teddy as I walked him the street. It was young and middle-aged Asian men, mainly Chinese men. Would you believe it? You'd never, ever expect that, because you would think Asian men are very taciturn and to themselves and don't show their emotion like everyone else, but perhaps even a little more so. But the dog melted a lot of the Asian guys, and I saw them smile, and I thought it was beautiful to see. That's something that you should know for a couple of reasons, which have no relevance whatsoever to the news. But what astounded me was how most people didn't even see a dog walking around amongst them. They were robotic. They didn't even notice them, you know. So now, before I'm going to take a few other calls on these wonderful topics in a minute, and then I'm going to talk about a wonderful film I saw late last night with its political implications to today's events. And the movie was called Shake Hands with the Devil, starring James Cagney, 1959, black and white, Turner Classic Movies, my favorite channel now. I just love that. I love the announcer. I love the elevated train. I love the whole thing about it. And then I settle back, and I know I'm going to get 2 hours of a movie, an hour and a half of a slower-paced movie from another time, shot in real film stock instead of video, so the depth is better. And it's particularly when you get a black-and-white movie, you're going to get not only depth, but you're going to get real color and great cinematography, as opposed to today's kind of overly processed Kodachrome, and I'm not knocking Kodachrome, Kodachrome-style colorization, which I don't like. And the reason I'm going to talk about James Cagney in this movie is I never thought he was such a great actor till I saw this. He plays a surgeon in Ireland in 1921, a teaching surgeon at a hospital, who by night is the leader of an underground movement for the Irish Republican Army. At that time, it wasn't called the IRA. It's quite gripping because the protagonist is not so much Cagney as it is an actor who plays an American medical student, a surgical student, who does not want to be involved in the fighting in Ireland, because he had just come back from World War I, and he said, I've seen enough killing in my lifetime. I'm a friend of yours, but I'm not going to kill anymore. That's how it starts. But eventually the American gets drawn into the battle, and it's against the black and tans, who are let's put it this way, a particularly vicious group of thugs sent in by the British military to terrorize and brutalize the Irish into submission. Now, the story is not only a beautiful art, beautiful in terms of art and a great story, but it has phenomenal relevance with regard to Israel slash the Palestinians, Iraq slash the Americans, and other such topics today. And I'm going to talk about it from the point of view of that movie, Tampa, Florida. Ken, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Mike. It's not a dog I'm talking about, but it's a 17-year-old cat, and golden cat, and it is an incredible story. I went on a trip to San Francisco. My brother lives in Reno, and we drove to San Francisco from there, and we had a hotel all set up, but we had no idea if we could get the cat in. So we figured, well, we better sneak the cat in. So we go through a whole incredible fiasco to get this cat in there. We get the cat in, and then we spend 3 days there, and we're leaving. And as you were talking about, who was more impressed with your dog? And it was amazing. When we left, I was walking the cat. I held the cat, and I walked right through the restaurant. And everybody, all the Orientals, I was in Japanese town, was so incredible. They were all just smiling and laughing, and they kept saying, "Tiger, tiger, tiger." It was amazing.
And it's funny because normally they wouldn't respond. They're very quiet people. They're not, let's say, they're not outgoing. But yet the animal brought that out, right? That's what you're getting at? I know it's very amazing. People don't believe this story.
They don't talk to you. But when,
right. Asian people love animals. That's the funny thing. Anyway, my friend, thank you. I want to move on to them because, I don't understand how fast the show is going, but I know what's going on now. I'm back into my old format, which is forgetting politics and talking in general about more interesting things, and the time just flies. So I want to go to the movie. Listen to me. Shake Hands with the Devil, 1959, starring James Cagney. So the plot summary is as follows, and it's directly relevant to today's troubles in the Middle East. Believe me, it is. In 1921 Dublin, the IRA of the time battles the Black and Tans, and they were special British forces who used extremely brutal measures against the Irish. Then there's the Irish-American medical student, Kerry O'Shea, hopes to stay out of it, but while saving a wounded friend, he gets outlawed and then drawn into the rebel organization under his former professor, James Cagney, the professor. Complications arise in the plot, and I don't want to give it away. But he falls in love with a beautiful English hostage, and she's gorgeous. I don't know who this actress was. I think I have her name here. Jennifer Curtis. Never heard of her. Stunning. She could have been a big actress today. She had genuine beauty as opposed to the silicone frauds that are in Hollywood today, and doesn't look like a slut, mind you. We're not talking about cheap white trash, you know, who get away with it with a little silicone and slut-like behavior because of the vermin who run Hollywood. This was a classy lady. Here's the story and how it relates to the Middle East, in my opinion. You watch the movie. Now, of course, it was written to be sympathetic to the Irish. There's no question about it. And I'm sure that it was written with that intent. And it was written with that intent and played by Cagney, I'm sure, because he's Irish and wanted to show the side of the Irish, not the English. Now, without getting drawn into that whole English-Irish thing, please, let's not go there for the moment. I want to draw a parallel to what's going on in the world today. Towards the end of the movie, the general who was leading the IRA, who was not Cagney, is very happy because the British have agreed to a peace treaty. And the peace treaty will grant the Irish dominion, their own parliament, and whatnot. And then there's a showdown with Cagney, the surgeon, who says, "I'm not signing it." He said, "We agreed that we'd fight to the end to have total freedom." The general says, "But this is better than killing and bloodshed, which will go on forever if we don't sign it." And Cagney says, "The only reason they're offering you anything at all is because we've got him beat. I'm going to fight him to the end." So the general says, "Well, we're not going to fight him." He says, "Well, then there'll be a civil war between us and you." He said, "But we fought shoulder to shoulder," he says to Cagney, "for all these years." He said, "Well, that doesn't matter. I'll fight you to the end." Anyway, as the movie moves on, Cagney is shown to be a cold-blooded murderer, even though he's a surgeon and he's quite a sympathetic character through most of the movie. He is seen at the end for what he really has become, which is simply a bloodthirsty, psychopathic murderer. From all the years of violence, he has become an unredeemable man. The Palestine Authority, whether you like them or you don't like them is irrelevant, want a homeland of their own. Whether you think it's right or wrong doesn't matter. There are 3 million Palestinians, and they're going to have their homeland. It's just an imperative of time. It's just going to happen, period. You don't have to like it. You don't have to like it at all. Or you can love it. It doesn't matter. They're going to have a homeland of their own. Now, then you've got elements within them who are so bloodthirsty, they've been steeped since childhood to hate and kill Jews, that they will never, ever sign a peace treaty. And just as in this movie, Shake Hands with the Devil, just as Cagney is killed off in the end because he's a bloodthirsty devil, that's what has to happen in Israel. And it's going to happen from within within the Palestinian Authority itself. They have to kill off the psychopaths amongst themselves to bring peace to the area, relative peace, and to see a two-state solution to the area. Only when the devil, 1959, black and white. And one more note about it, which is the imagery. The directing was pretty good, but by today's standards, you know, when a guy gets shot and there's no blood and there's no bullet wound, it doesn't make sense, that kind of thing. But the imagery is fantastic. The cinematography is extraordinary. The beautiful B&W photography is great. The director's Michael Anderson, cinematographer Erwin Hillier. And here you have a director at work who understands what he's doing. He understands the purpose of the movie, and he has the creative capacity to pull off what he's trying to do. It's a very unusual movie for its time. And I believe, although I'm not an expert on it, Scorsese and Spielberg are saying that this director's work, Michael Anderson, is deserving of much greater recognition. So I highly recommend the movie, Shake Hands with the Devil, and it's based on a novel by the same name, by Reardon Connor. Reardon Connor, if you're looking for a rental. I just love Turner Classic Movies. Love the guy's intros to them. Savage. Kentucky. Adam, you're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind? Go ahead, please.
Yes, Dr. Savage, you're absolutely right about the repo business. That's what I do. We've been doing about 50% above normal since last September.
You're a repo man, and it is a good business.
Oh, yes, sir.
What kind of items are you repossessing?
Well, right now we're sticking to pickup trucks and semi-trucks. I can't tell you how many trucks I've...
But are the people basically just abandoning payments and saying, take it back? Is that it?
That's what they're doing, and usually they're doing that in order to save their house from going back.
Oh, that's sad. That's terrible. That is just terrible. The people are just that close to the edge. That's a horrible thing. So what do you do with a repossessed truck? Where does it go?
Well, different states have different laws, but most states state that it must go to auction and get a certain number of bids before it's sold.
But who buys them? I mean, if the trucks are no longer in favor, who buys them?
Well, right now you're getting trucks dirt cheap. Usually they end up on other car lots.
So, in other words, people are still buying the trucks, but they're buying them for like 50 cents on the dollar or something like that.
Yes, sir, that's right.
Maybe I should buy a truck. I don't really need one. I'll look into it. Probably a good time to buy one. I got gas guzzlers. I kind of think about it. I got very heavy fuel-consuming cars, but I pay for it. It's not your business. What's your business if I pay for the gas? I don't understand it. If I'm willing to pay all this money per gallon, I mean, I don't like it. I wish the car got 100 miles to a gallon, but it doesn't. If it's a high, I'd love to have if you can get me a sun car, a car that runs on like the sun's energy and it can go as fast as my car does from 20 to 100, I'll take it. Will it make the same sounds coming out of the tailpipe? I wonder. That is something to behold. 20 to 100 is quite a speed on a car. I grew up in another era. I like gas guzzlers. Not because I like them to guzzle gas. I like what they do. I like their sound. I like their heft and feel. I like the safety of a big car. I hate little cars. I've always hated little cars. Never enjoyed them. I just like a big car. I'm driving the Navigator again. I kept it in a garage for a while. I enjoy it. It's big. It doesn't have fussy little fruity San Francisco tires that break when you touch a curb. My other cars, you touch a curb, whoop! The light, it has a computer. Your right tire is deflated. It went down by 2 pounds. Call Stuttgart. Hello, Hans. My tire is losing air. This car, you could jump a curb and hit a hydrant and the thing keeps rolling. Plus, I guarantee you, with my big navigator, nobody in the Prius, they think twice. They look at it. You could see them trying to angle and cut you off from the right. Then they look at my eyes in the rearview mirror, and they see the size of the tire spinning by their head. And you see them just at the last minute. They say, well, maybe I shouldn't cut that guy off. There's something to be said for a big American car. Maybe I'll go look for a new one at a half price now. I don't know what's going to be left after this is all over. All of our big cars are gone. God only knows what's going to happen to the boating market. Mwah! You wouldn't want to be a boat dealer with a twin 1,000 horsepower Caterpillars right now for sale, would you? With an 07 still on the lot, so to speak. Yeah, special deal. We got 2,000 horsepower Caterpillar engines in there that only burn 70 GPH, so 70 gallons per hour. Real bargain. No, I tell you, my boat has Cummins diesels, and I'm lucky. They're really good. I get about 10 or 11 gallons per hour. That's a very good, fuel-efficient boat for a boat that's 19 tons. First of all, I don't go fast. What am I to speed in a boat for? If I want a speedboat, I'll buy a speedboat. This is not a speedboat. It's a 19-ton cruiser. So I do 10 knots, 11 knots. I put it on autopilot. I go out with the dog when I do on a calm day, and I eat a sandwich on the foredeck. What is wrong with that? Am I hurting somebody? I'm personally offending you, the kayaker. How'd you get your kayak to the water's edge, schmuck? You drove it in a car, usually on an SUV, and then you get on the water and you act like you're holier than me. You think you're Nanook of the North. So I'm supposed to believe you came down from the Aleutian Islands personally in your kayak and that you're treading lightly on the ocean. That's what they play, or these bicyclists here on these two-lane roads. I don't know why the CHP, the California Highway Patrol, doesn't arrest these bicyclists. They're such asses. They're jackasses of the lowest order. And I ride a bike every day. But believe me, I don't cut cars off. I don't hog the road. You see these jerks, most of whom are lawyers from San Francisco. They like to show you their keister. They ride right next to you, and they won't pull over you. It's a two-lane road. And if you try to pass them, they give you the finger. Oh, I had a doozy last week. A couple, a man and a woman blocking the entire road, left and right. So I went around them. I went in the other lane. They got so mad that I had the nerve to go in the other lane and I didn't get blocked by them. They went furious.
Savage.